now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Right.
And if you
yes, we are recording.
Hooray!
I'm Phil Lairness, and that voice you heard of someone probably going to say something he didn't want to, that is the one and only, the screwed on eBay, Dean Haglund.
Hey!
Back down under.
Back. A whirlwind tour of the Americas.
So,
as we said,
this, you went from LA to Detroit, Detroit to Houston, and then you told me something crazy that, was it Houston? I think, where was your connecting flight out of?
Yeah, Houston.
And
yeah.
I think you told me that, like, Houston to Sydney is the longest flight possible anywhere in the world.
Yes, I think it stretches the gas consumption of the most gas economic plane out there, the Dreamliner 9. Boeing's 777, I believe it is, or 787. And at that 17-hour, 35-minute flight uses up almost all the fuel specifically. So you can't really get a longer flight if you wanted to. The same plane goes from Perth to London nonstop as well in 15 hours.
So to remind our loyal listeners and to bring up to speed new listeners, Dean was in Detroit home hunting and
home hunting.
Weren't you? Isn't that what you were doing?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Home hunting and sussing out the future of performing.
Well, but that's what you do anywhere. I mean, Dean Haglund, You know what that guy is? He is a susser of the future of performing. That guy right there. See, if you want to know about the future of performing, Dean Haglund has sussed that all out for you.
I sussed that out.
So what I love is, you know, you'll mention in passing that Dean Haglund stopped by L.A. on his way through Detroit to record a podcast. And that begs a lot of questions. What is Dean doing in Detroit? Which, of course, begs the obvious observation that the person asking that question doesn't listen to this goddamn show. Which seems to lead to more questions and recriminations towards you about giving up on Australia or whatever.
So we shouldn't shame people for not listening to the entire show.
I do.
I know you do.
If you are going to ask the goddamn question, it would almost apparently be easier for us to one by one go to everybody's house, because apparently there is no way for them to find the answer. Oh wait, I'm sorry, that is a mistake. I've found it. There's a website where you can find every episode we have ever done. You can even do a term search on that website for Detroit and the .com, CHILLPAKHollywood.com. You can download and stream every episode of the show that has been changing the way people listen to the internet for more than 11 years. Welcome
11 years
to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody.
Yeah.
So
without the rage, we're all forgiving in this show.
You once said our motto was guilting people into listening one person at a time.
Oh,
I think that was
God.
At Dragon Con you once said that. So
that's right.
Anyway,
I think we did that too.
Enough about that. How was it? Tell me everything about the Motor City.
Wow. It's the comeback city for the comeback kid. That's how I'm signing off my emails from now on. That town is amazing. Bouncing back, there's fantastic pockets of high-end fun stuff. There's art everywhere. The comedy scene is vibrant.
You come for the future of performing, but you stay for the pockets of high-end fun stuff.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, I had a rental car, and let me tell you, I rarely give Yelp reviews, but Avis's practice of renting on a rainy night is something close to a mental asylum that I've never seen the likes of. So after waiting 45 minutes in line, we're finally told to go stand outside for a Nissan Altima, which after 15 minutes doesn't show up, to which they said, oh, here, take this Jeep that had been running the entire 15 minutes, just with nobody in there, just the engine running, just sitting there. Here, take this one. They said, well, go change your paperwork. And the guy comes out and gives me the keys and the paperwork, and I drive off, and in the little dash it says, hey, key fob not with car. And we read it, and it's actually for another Jeep, a red Renegade, and we're in a gray Cherokee. Turn around, say this is in the key. They can't find that key, so they just say, oh, get in that car. The next one beside it. Leave this one running. Get in that other one. It's a Chevy Equinox. Here, we'll find it. Here, there's the key. Just get out of here. You've been here 2 hours already. Oh, my God. So, Avis, the quality of organization.
It never occurred to you that this was a business in the midst of a robbery, and the people you were dealing with were, in fact, not employees.
Oh, my God. All of a sudden, now that totally makes sense.
So, it's safe to say that this Avis dealership, not in one of the pockets of high-end fun.
It's right by the airport. It's the airport Avis. That's the funny thing.
So,
and, you know, oh my gosh.
So what so is the what the is the future of performing?
The future of performing. There's some improv comedy clubs, very nice theaters in Detroit that after a couple of successful meetings seem to want me to be there in open arms, teaching and performing. And then, of course, I had back in the 90s done many a comedy club in Ann Arbor, Dearborn, and all the Michigan hotspots. And so I will probably be going back. I didn't get outside Metro Detroit much. So I will be going back to Ann Arbor and Dearborn and seeing the old haunts from 20 years ago to hit the boards again. Wow. So,
and
yeah,
you have,
I know.
You have an agent, do you not, in Toronto? Is that right?
Yes, a theatrical agent in Toronto who's already been getting me auditions. So there's plenty of work up in Canada for a dual citizen holder like me, and Toronto being a mere 4 hours by train, no less.
Canadian television royalty, as you are.
Well, you know, in Canada, we don't go through the ceremony anymore to attain royal status on television. But yes, if that ceremony was still in place, maybe perhaps I would be arrogant enough to say that I would be.
I don't know much about Canadian ceremony, but I do imagine that it involves drinking beers out of the trunk of a car.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember my dad doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. I loved it. And that is a ceremony that travels. That's the beauty of it. Travels all over North America. Anyway, you're not hiding any illegals in the trunk of this car, are you? No, they're all domestic beer. All domestic beer. So what about domicile? Did we find a domicile that appealed to us?
We didn't, but we have a great real estate agent who very fond of. Those may remember the keyboard player from the Devil City Murderers, a Seattle punk band back in the 90s. She is now selling us our house.
Oh, so good. So you'll be staying with the real estate agent. Is that what?
No. She's on the look.
On the lookout. Okay.
On the lookout. We found some very unusual places that have been on the market for some time for obvious reasons. And really, no, nobody should live in such conditions. But
but you know what areas. You now know what areas, and you know what they're near, and you've walked those ancient Empire streets. I don't know what that. What Empire?
I don't know what
Motown. Motown.
Motown. We did the Motown.
So, and did you hook up with our friend Matty Giles?
Oh, it was so close. My my Avis experience screwed it over so badly that we did not get to anything resembling what could have been a bar till 12:30 at night, and his flight was at 6 a.m. Off to Seattle. So the one week he decides to go to Seattle for the first time is the one week I come to do
so
Detroit.
So no Detroit walking tour for you.
No.
Courtesy of Matty.
No.
D. All right.
No, unfortunately. But it was a delightful phone call and a follow-up email and all that. So it was helpful, brief, and he was right about the potholes. I'll say that.
That was a punk band out of Dearborn, right?
No, the road conditions in some areas, there's quite a lot of severe potholes.
Okay, all right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I meant.
And before we move on to some of the midnight Avis Detroit airport equivalent that I have for you in Tony Los Feliz and adjacent Silver Lake, do you want to explain what it means that Dean Haglin was screwed by eBay, or are we leaving that unspoken?
No, we leave that. People get screwed on eBay all the time. It's just I didn't realize the reserve price. That's all. That's not really being screwed.
You didn't know it was your turn. That's what you did. People are screwed all the time.
Exactly.
I didn't know that my number had come up. Okay.
And it wasn't screwed. You just outbid. So it's not like I lost money or anything.
All right.
It's just, you know, you wait till the last 12 seconds and then the guy has the auto bidding thing.
Because our listenership is not legion, but they are mighty, and they were certainly ready to do battle on your behalf.
No. It's strictly just outbid on an automatic bidding process.
A sad doesn't quite cover it. A gut punch of a weekend here in L.A. I taught all weekend, an acting intensive, and it was extraordinary. And maybe someday I'll talk about some of these acting intensives if it's interesting and if it's a slow news week. But but I come out of the acting intensive at the Ranger House, the old historic Ranger House on the property of Friendship Auditorium. This was the old Griffith Park Ranger House that got moved and restored by the Breakfast Club. And it's now where we have our foundation meetings and where Phil Lairness is found teaching acting classes on weeknights and acting intensives, you know, every so many months on weekends.
Right.
And I come out of this workshop last night, get into the car with Lily, and am heading over the hill right there to our Trader Joe's, just a couple blocks away.
Yes.
And I've been aware that all my actors in the intensive have been doing really extraordinary work while the soundtrack of overhead helicopters has accompanied them all afternoon long, driving me nuts. But But as I'm pulling out of the parking lot, Lily reads a text from Aaron Petrulis that says, "Hey, are you guys all right?" Well, why wouldn't we be all right? And
yeah, we should start with that.
And I stop the car right there, and Lily is, "What are you doing? You go this way, go this way." And I said, "Don't you think we better look why she might be saying that? Because it could be tied in with these helicopters." And sure enough, the Trader Joe's, where just the night before Lily and I were stuck when our battery died in that parking lot. Yeah. 24 hours before. Yes. That very Trader Joe's, a barricade situation, an active shooter situation. And so, you know, those are the things where, you know, you hear these stories about people. I was supposed to be on that flight, but I missed my bus or I missed my whatever, you know, and you wonder, wow, I guess my ticket wasn't up. I guess it wasn't my time, you know, and and I think about that. Like, not only do I think about the fact that we were stuck there in that parking lot waiting for AAA, but how I had thought, you know, our cat was waiting home alone for so long and everything. We don't know how long AAA is going to be. Should I walk the 40 minutes home to make sure that the cat's okay and let Lily wait for AAA? And boy, something like this happens and you go, no, you don't leave your partner alone ever if you can avoid
it. Ever.
Because you don't know what could happen. That's the sad reality of life. So anyway, this this active shooter situation, a man from a part of Los Angeles I had never heard of in my 30-something years of living here, Newton. Yeah, a neighborhood in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Drives from 32nd Street in a high-speed pursuit with his gunshot girlfriend by his side in his grandmother's car. His grandmother, he shot 7 times.
Wow.
Boy, that's one mean grandma, I guess.
Or a lot of rage packed in there.
I guess. But one mean grandma, because I understand she survived it. Honest.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. At least she had by the point we're recording this. So we're obviously we hope. So he crashes the car outside this Trader Joe's, runs in to barricade himself, gets into crossfire with the cops who are pursuing them. A woman dies, a manager of the store dies, and the use of language. Now, this is media coverage. How odd is it to realize that all of America, except those viewers watching Fox News, because Fox News never cut away to cover this, because Fox News, not big fans of California, by the way.
Oh, is that why?
Yeah. Fox News viewers really apparently have a lot of judgment towards L.A. At least those Fox News viewers in my family do. So they never cut away. But every other network, it was pretty much go time on the Trader Joe's coverage. And it was fascinating how the language was always that we don't know if this woman was shot by the gunman or if she was shot by the crossfire between the gunman and police. That's how they would put it everywhere. So we can't say, apparently, we don't know whether she was shot by the gunman or by the police. The police could not have shot her, but she might have been shot by the crossfire. That is some tricky play with language right there.
Right. So theoretically,
clearly we're sending the message that the blame for anything that happened is on the gunman. And I'm not disagreeing with that. We don't know anything to suggest otherwise, to suggest that it's the cops that began the crossfire. That may come out. Who knows? That investigation. I don't mean to imply that. I'm not implying any kind of cover-up or conspiracy. I'm just saying it's a rather specific use of language that just smacks me of such political correctness, because we live in a time when cops are guilty of sometimes shooting people, and we don't want to send that message. So the message we're going to try to craft is one that lets you know that no matter how this turned out, it was not the cop's fault, right?
Right.
I don't know. To me, it was such a painful attempt to wrap language around a message we were trying to send. Instead of just saying, look, she might have been shot by the cops. And this will happen when people have guns and open fire on cops.
Right.
Innocent people get hurt.
Fly.
Yeah, innocent people get hurt. Yeah. And that's why sometimes the answer towards keeping people safe in the face of a bad guy with a gun is not good guys with guns.
Right.
You know, especially if those people are not really, really well trained, right? Because that's a debate that's going on where you hear that. The answer to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Well, not for the innocent bystander. It's not always, right? So
that's true.
Anyway, that was one interesting thing. The other thing was, and this was hilarious to me, Dean, and I held court for no length of time on this thing, another such a stretch about why the Trader Joe's needed to be kept closed. Like, they needed to justify this. Well, it's an ongoing crime scene and investigation, but they also have to sweep the location. And, you know, they've got to make sure no one else is in there. And but the police expert doesn't stop there. He starts coming up with all the hypotheticals that they need to check. Like, there could be someone hiding who's locked in a meat locker. There might be someone who, in a effort to escape, fell and hit their head. There may be someone. This went on. It was a never-ending list. So I then decided to join in with my own list. And the guy kept going. But, I mean, you know, it was great. Like, someone might have been playing with a sharp stick and fallen and stabbed somebody else's eye out. Somebody might have used an unclean towel and come down with a case of conjunctivitis. Pink eye is serious. The stress of someone being caught in the crossfire might have led to erectile dysfunction. Someone who is, who has a wheat allergy, someone who is on a strict gluten-free diet may have been forced to hide with their back against the bread. So,
right.
There's so much that, anyway, that was what I loved. I just loved how we fill. We need to fill. We got to keep it going. We can't cut away. So what can we do? Let's list all the imaginary, phony, awful things that might have happened. And that
my
was
God.
What they did. And this is what
that sounds like.
You know, this is one of my favorite things, is not talking about necessarily what's going on in the world, but talking about how the media is talking about those things. So, nobody listens either to the language that's being used. And as a result, there's a question that's being thrown that gets cut away from on all these networks. Nobody goes to it. Nobody pays attention to it. None of these reporters follow up on it. But somebody throws out the question during, I think, the mayor's press conference immediately afterwards of, can you talk about this happening at the same time as what happened to Jonathan Gold? And I hear this, and immediately I'm like, what? What happened to Jonathan Gold? And for people who don't know, of course, Jonathan Gold is, can we call him the most celebrated gourmand in Los Angeles history?
The only Pulitzer Prize winning author of food.
Of restaurant
basically.
Reviews. Yeah. He is truly famous. I mean, a truly famous restaurant critic, longtime critic for the LA Times. But the author, of so many books and the subject of that wonderful documentary, City of Gold. And whether you are a foodie or not, there was something, first of all, he was such a delightful writer. And you would learn about the history, the architecture, the neighborhoods of this city, and the human stories that make this city interesting through his writing. That he did wonderfully well. That makes him, well, that's why he wins the Pulitzer, quite frankly. It's not his palate that wins him that. It's that he's a great writer. But the other thing is, I don't know of many people who could say they did more to break down ethnic, cultural, and neighborhood barriers the way that Jonathan Gold did. He made exploring foreign neighborhoods within your own city something that seemed fun to do.
Absolutely. In fact, he is famous, is he not, for eating at every restaurant on Pico Boulevard sequentially from Santa Monica all the way through East LA down to La Hombra, wherever Pico ends over there, and going block
by back,
block.
And then back the other way.
And then back the other way on the other side of the street.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in terms of that, I mean, the cultural diversity that you find on Pico, from the tawny Santa Monica shores to the somewhat grittier, at the time he did it, the downtown L.A. when Pico ran through, was pretty tough.
And so this also does this other thing, doesn't it, that it suddenly makes the whole idea of food criticism and connoisseurship no longer, at least in his hands, a activity that's class-based, right? It's not about
just the opposite.
I'm going into these neighborhoods for 5-star or 4-star restaurants. No, it's all of them. What are the delights in any place that serves food? What's the story of any place that serves food? And what can we take away from it that's nourishing, both in terms of what they serve and how they make it, and also the story behind it?
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, so the
connection? I mean, he died.
So he died. So but he dies. Right then. I mean, he dies. while this shooting is going on. So it's just this kind of double punch. You know, our city is a lesser place without Jonathan Gold was a great ambassador and again a great person. You know, he broke down barriers and broke down walls and brought us together. And there couldn't be anything that's more counter to that than people hiding behind walls during a shooting. And of course, there was a very recent photo of him right in front of that Trader Joe's celebrating Trader Joe's for what they do.
Right.
And so it was a double whammy that really sucked to Dean Haglund. And worst of all, I must say, what kind of made me most mad was all this national coverage. And at no point, and this is going to sound like a joke, but I don't mean it as a joke. I understand that it shows how bizarre I am, but I don't mean it as a joke. But during all this coverage, nobody at any point ever says, and that Trader Joe's is directly across the street from Walt Disney's Edendale studio, from his very first studio. Nobody says that. I mean, movie
it's
making.
It's not his very first. The first one is at that copy store.
Well, that's his first animation house, but not his first studio because he worked for, what was it, Universal at that time. So it's the first studio that he owns where he owns production and, you know, so full service motion picture studio, not animation shop. And it's right there. It's at Gelson's and there's a landmark sign. It's right across the street. So it all begins right there. And why that matters and why I think that should be shared is, I mean, it's just, it gives a reason maybe that some people could understand of why this is so horrific for us. It's not just the Trader Joe's where so many of us go, where the mayor himself shopped every week when he was a councilman from that neighborhood. But it's also, it's the heart of what so much of us love about this city that was under attack. So
the history and all that.
Whoo, there you go. All right. Not the only celebrity death to discuss, Dean Haglund. So let's invite Garrett Watley just to say two magical words.
Celebrity deaths.
Adrian Cronauer died. Dean, do you remember Adrian Cronauer?
No. Give me a hint.
Good morning, Vietnam.
Ah, of course. The DJ from Vietnam who Robin Williams portrayed in Good Morning Vietnam.
Absolutely. Died at 79 years of age during his service as a U.S. Air Force sergeant in Vietnam in 65 and 66. He opened his Armed Forces radio show with that phrase, Good Morning Vietnam. And of course, Robin Williams made him famous in the 1987 Oscar-nominated film, loosely based on Cronauer's time in Saigon. The guy's kind of interesting and had some interesting comments, so I just thought I would share a couple of these really quick. The military wanted, first of all, the movie was a departure from other Vietnam films at the time because it was less a war film and more about
comedy.
Well, but it was also about challenging the rules when the rules are illogical and leave no room for humanity, right?
And, that's right, yeah.
And we do find those rules a lot in places of war, of course. But that was more what it was about. And the government at the time wanted conservative programming for their American youths, right? They wanted clean-cut guys, and they were going to give them middle-of-the-road kind of programming. But as Cronauer said, you know, America's youth at that time... they were not into that. They were not into the drab, sterile announcements, middle-of-the-road music, et cetera, et cetera. So he changed up the playlist. Right. He was not the fast-talking, yuck-it-up, nonconformist disc jockey that Robin Williams played. Robin Williams was playing a variation on Robin Williams' stand-up character, which is what you would expect. But in context of the time, I bet... the shock of hearing Cronauer was no less impactful than listening to Robin Williams do his stand-up 20-something years later.
Yeah, it had the same anti-authoritarianism and wild seemingly connecting to 18-year-old men who were over there serving. more so than the 35-year-old generals.
Yeah,
that would.
And you know what's great about it? And again, in this day and age, it's why it's worth remembering someone like Kronauer, is the anti-authoritarianism of it. It led, when Good Morning Vietnam came out, Jesse Jackson to call and ask if Kronauer would help out with his presidential campaign. And the conversation died quickly when Kronauer pointed out that he was a Republican. In fact, in George H.W. Bush's reelection campaign in 92, there was a taped TV ad slamming Bill Clinton's draft record. And in that ad, it was Kronauer accusing Clinton of being a liar.
Wow.
So he was a conservative. He was a lifelong conservative, as he said. As he said, look, a lifelong card-carrying Republican can't be that much of an anti-establishment type. Well, maybe now they can. But anyway, you know, he was the son of a steel worker and a school teacher. He spent 21 years in television, advertising, teaching, and freelancing before attending law school. And the one thing he says is that, you know, just because you're conservative doesn't mean you can't be an iconoclast, right? And just because you're not anti-military or anti-establishment per se doesn't mean you can't be anti-stupidity.
And that's the thing. Stupid is stupid, and it crosses any political line. If you see,
but now, of course, where we live, no, it's tribal, and I'm going to stand up for the stupidity of anyone on my team, which is why this is all going off the rails so much. Because as you've heard me say altogether too often, I'm of the mindset that we hold the people on our team to a higher standard. The people that we agree with, those are the ones we hold their feet to the fire, and we expect better than them because they're on our team. A good teammate elevates the game of those people on his team, brings out the best in them. Because if we do what we do well, it doesn't matter what the other team does.
Right. Right. And that is the thing. How do we do what we do well? First, we have to know what we do.
So this brings back to comedy, I think, because we need comedy to challenge stupidity, to challenge the establishment, to challenge conventional wisdom when that wisdom is not at all wise. So it brings to mind this latest controversy that has come up during Comic-Con involving James Gunn being fired as director of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies.
Right. I missed this controversy. Kill me in.
Well, he's been fired ostensibly because of tweets that he made, inappropriate jokes, about 10 years ago involving NAMBLA and other, you know, North American Man Boy Love Association. For those who don't know, one of our original sponsors back when we were from the heart of Hollywood. Hey, there's going to be a movement to fire me from this podcast. And quite frankly, people can have me. I'll go gladly, willingly into that good night. But the point was, he made this joke 10 years ago, these jokes 10 years ago or whatever. I'm not defending him or defending the jokes, but a big movement, came to, remove him. And it was a movement by conservatives. And, it follows on the heels. Now, it was about the old tweets that he made, but it follows on the heels, James Gunn calling out fellow filmmaker and actor Mark Duplass for tweeting his not support of Ben Shapiro, the young person's philosopher, as he's been called, a conservative pundit, the founder and editor of The Daily Wire. Ben Shapiro, a young conservative who for the last couple of years has been kind of a voice of reason on the conservative side, trying to check Donald Trump and Trumpism's worst, ugliest, most destructive impulses. But because of that track record, and because Ben Shapiro had been nice and supportive of Mark Duplass in the past for no reason other than to be nice and supportive, Mark Duplass wrote his support saying, hey, if you want to know what conservatives think and how people different from you think, you could do a lot worse than follow this guy. This guy doesn't fuck around with the facts. He gives his opinion based on those facts. And he's a good guy, and he's helped me in all this. Okay, so he said you might want to follow him. Well, then the wolves came out, and I'm not saying this is wrong. They then pointed out some of the things Ben Shapiro had tweeted about in the past, and Mark right. Duplass was quite shocked about some of these things. They did not seem to have been tweeted by the person that he had been reading and following.
Right.
So this is point one about the world in which we live. You are always accountable for every past thing you tweeted now.
Okay, but here's the problem. Do I not grow? Do I not say something and someone says that's inappropriate and I have a learning moment, an educational moment, which at that point, I don't do that ever again. I have a growth curve of education.
Yeah, and I would say that the same growth curve needs to be allowed for both Ben Shapiro and needs to be allowed for, in this case, James Gunn. But also Mark Duplass could have said, instead of getting freaked out about it, as maybe he was when these tweets were brought to his attention, like, oh, God, the guy's a monster. Well, the guy's young. Ben Shapiro's very young, the conservative philosopher, which is why he has an impact with young people. But, oh, man, God, I read old journals that I wrote when I was in the 20s, and I only now am at the point where I refuse to feel ashamed about the things that I wrote, because what good does it do for me to just make some 20-year-old version of myself feel more ashamed, right? Every 20-year-old is carrying around so much shame anyway. But Mark Duplass could have said, wow, I had never read those things. Nevertheless, what he writes now still holds everything that I've said. Still holds.
Right.
No matter what positions he used to hold, this is who he is now from what I've read. So that still holds. And if he writes something, truly offensive, truly wrongheaded, truly reprehensible, I'll hold him accountable for that.
Great.
But James Gunn had a good response to being fired by Disney. He said they did the right thing. They did the only thing they could do. There should be accountability. As I have said many times before, what I used to tweet about those jokes weren't funny. They were wrong. I am sorry. All I can say is I am a better person. I am the person now who knows those things were wrong. All I can do is continue to try to be the best person that I can be. That was the right response to take. To not fight it, because how are you going to fight it? That's just giving fight more fuel. You're letting fight win at that point. But now there's a movement again to try to hire him back. But I want to ask you about this. Is this a scary time for comedy? Because if comedians are held to account for their worst impulses in jokes, how will mores ever get challenged?
Well, excellent point. I think that there are ways to craft jokes that are both challenging the mores and not inoffensive. And therein lies the craft, right? It's not, hey, have you ever noticed this is bullshit? This is, and come at it like that, but go about it other ways, less, satirical, improvisationally. So on and so forth. So, but at the same time, we are somehow have taken sandpaper to a lot of our senses that are continually inflamed, so that even the slightest thing it becomes enrageful and hurtful. And I think that is a problem more so than the restrictions on the mores, because when you do colleges, there is, I didn't say politically correct, but there is things that you don't want to say because you'll alienate some of your audience.
Oh, please, I don't know. This is a little bit scary. There is no place where freedom of speech is more endangered than on college campuses. You know, and no more so apparently than Berkeley. The birth of the free speech movement is the place that keeps banning speakers before they have a chance to speak, because it's determined that what they're going to say, you know, is going to be so controversial, and everybody's already rioting about it before they ever say it. So everyone from conservative pundits to Bill Maher have been disinvited from ever speaking there.
Right. And this becomes the thing about how one says controversial things, how, you know, it's not so much, it's the what that gets transmitted inappropriately through mediated forms, be it press, radio, Twitter, whatever. However, that can be said, the similar things that they're saying in humorous ways, in more subtle ways, in artistic ways. And I see both sides of the point, but I think there's a third way.
Yes, that's a great point.
There's a third way.
You know, James,
to get...
Well, James Gunn referenced this, I think, actually, when he says that he acknowledges that his jokes were out of line and he was just attempting to be controversial. He was courting controversy. And that's where I think part of your third path comes into play, which is, okay, be honest, comedian. Are you courting controversy or are you trying to craft the joke? If you're crafting the joke and it fails and it falls out of bounds, that's one thing. But if what you're doing is dancing on that line because you want controversy and the publicity that comes with it, well, then
get a rise out of the crowd.
Yeah, then I don't have, because that, you know, that's the thing, you know, even we you know, we talked about with Alex Jones a little bit, you know, and what was clear was that, you know, he doesn't mean all the things that he says, and a lot of the things that he says is to be a provocateur. Now, all these years on, we don't know what that is and how much of that is. But that's a dangerous place, and also maybe an irresponsible place, because I could make a case, not legally, but practically, that if you as a comedian or as a broadcaster are courting controversy intentionally rather than I'm making a point that I think is important. As my mind. If I'm courting controversy intentionally, well, then you are yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Absolutely. And to do, I mean, and now more than ever, it's so easy to court controversy because everything is controversial insofar as we're looking for controversy. The media, we are selling clicks by courting controversy, by finding it. So I think it is a fool's errand to go and court controversy without putting some intelligent thought behind the topics you are relating to and pointing out where, you know, a la Good Morning Vietnam, where things, systems, organizations are idiotic and destructive.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it's about... In this day and age, honestly, you don't even have to court it. I mean, for crying out loud, controversy comes looking for anybody. And so it's about, okay, I better learn how to dance with controversy if I'm going to call out stupidity.
Well, and think it through. Like, not just craft your stand you're going to take. So that you're not just saying something stupid on 140 characters and then going to bed half corked on a bottle of wine.
Exactly.
But, you know.
Well, it's not even about making a stand. That's why I say it's about dancing with controversy. Because you can't just make a stand and say, here it is. You know, it's going to be
shifting.
You can't make an opinion. You can't make a statement at this point without courting controversy. Everybody's going to try to turn your point, no matter how good, into something it isn't. And you've got to be prepared for that. So how are you going to dance with that? And as you know, as a classically trained modern dancer, it takes a lot of work to develop the craft of dancing with anything, let alone controversy.
Yes, it requires strength and flexibility. And I think those two things are both either you have one or not the other, but in dance classes, the two things you're working on is to be both. strength and strong and supple. Well, and
Detroit is about to get
metaphor.
Detroit's about to get a lot more strong and supple.
That's right. I am about to massage and plie. I don't know what that meant.
Yeah, I don't know. Hey, I was disappointed that you weren't here, at least a day longer or so here in Los Angeles, so that you could have come with me to Paramount Ranch for the 31st anniversary Hollywood Heritage Silence Under the Stars, where we saw 1928's King Vidor silent comic masterpiece, Show People.
Oh, yes. Show People. How was that?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
It's a cavalcade of 71 stars, wasn't it?
Well, it is, because it's a behind-the-scenes look. So it's amazing, because 1928, sound is already starting, right? And so what's fascinating about it is that this serves almost as a love letter to the perfected art form of silent film, because it goes behind the scenes and it tells the tale of Marion Davies as an aspiring actress and her boyfriend, a kind of B-rate, one-reel or two-reel comedic actor, William Haynes, who helps her break in to the business. But then she identifies with her desire to be a dramatic star and how her life outside of that needs to match it, you know. And so that comes between them before they come back together again. No role was better for Marion Davies, because she gets to actually play a few different roles. She gets to play the naive, hopeful waif. She gets to play the celebrated comedic actress. She gets to play the dramatic diva. She gets to play the detached woman who's cut off from all the source of her creativity to begin with.
Mm.
Oh, and by the way, she gets to play Marion Davies. She's one of the stars that has a cameo. Marion Davies plays herself in a movie where she also stars as another character.
And how is that possible?
It's hilarious. And she's on screen together. And it's terrific. It is terrific. It's done in camera, of course. And they had mastered filmmaking. I don't need to tell you that. But they had mastered the art of visual storytelling. And it is a love letter to that. But like I said, it's moving and it's funny. And this guy, William Haynes. Even King Vidor shows up as the director of one of the movies she's starring in. But William Haynes is her co-star, and he plays this like I said, this kind of clown, this silent clown. The kind of guy that was good looking enough to be a quasi romantic lead in a two reeler, but not a romantic lead in a feature, right? And a gifted clown for a two-reeler, but not for elaborate gags. And this actor, William Haynes, has such great chemistry with her. And what I love about that fact is that his career was cut short in the mid-30s because he refused to deny his homosexuality.
Oh.
And,
did not know that.
And we still face this to this day, this idea that no one will believe the chemistry between actors if they know that someone's gay, right? And as if being heterosexual gives two people chemistry, as if liking each other gives people chemistry. I mean, one of the things, Dean, that has maintained our sexual chemistry on this show for 11 years is how much we infuriate each other.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a dick. Unbelievable. Yeah.
But think about
here
it.
We are.
The animosity, hatred, distaste for each other, that tension between actors is often what reads like attraction and chemistry.
That's true.
And
I keep watching Castle for that very reason.
So anyway, it was really a shame what happened to this guy. I mean, not blacklisted, not exactly like he was discovered to be gay and then was blacklisted. He was given every opportunity to deny it by the publicity machine. And there's such a wonderful send-up of the publicity machine about how they have to change everybody's story to make them appealing in the way that the studio thinks they will be appealing. Because, of course, the people running the studios know what the people want, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that's a joke that still works well, because I still watch a lot of movies and TV shows that make me think that the people who made them hate people. hate the very audience they're making them for. So
I've seen that show more than twice.
But anyway, it was great fun, and you're right, just so many stars Charlie Chaplin has a cameo in it that is, it's jaw-dropping. It's so terrific. And it's so fun getting to see Chaplin play Chaplin.
Right? Without the mustache.
But I mean, really play him. It wasn't that he was just playing a little tramp or anything, but playing him, and you got a sense of how much this tiny little man would dominate any room that he was in. Just the charm, the natural charm of this guy to run any meeting, you know?
And how was the print quality on this one? Because I know it's a hard to find film.
Dark.
Show people.
It was very dark. It was
difficult.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. And 16mm, it was a very, very difficult thing to watch. But with the live accompaniment of Michael Mortello, it was always, as ever, a delight. I saw one other classic era film from the 30s. A musical that won Best Picture from 1936, starring one of my favorites, William Powell, and starring Louise Rainer in an Oscar-winning role. And oh my God, is she good! Oh man, is Louise Rainer good! And my beloved Myrna Loy, frequent co-star of William Powell, as the real-life Billy Burke. Anyway, this was 1936. Is The Great Ziegfeld? Have you ever seen this?
Yes, this is the story of Ziegfeld himself, the showman.
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong. Yes, it's played by William
Powell. Yes.
No, is this where there's God as a cameo too?
No. So that's Ziegfeld Follies, where 10 years later they make a sequel because he dies at the end of this one. So the sequel is set in heaven and he's recreating some of his classic Follies routine.
That's right.
And that one's terrific. And this one, then that was Technicolor. And this one was black and white. And this one, Best Picture. And oh my God, the set pieces. Oh my God, almost every scene. Oh my God, this case is a working textbook for too much of a good thing is rotten.
oh my God, really?
Yeah. Yeah, this thing will not stop. This, you want this movie to stop auditioning. It got the job about an hour into it. But an hour into it, there's not even any musical numbers yet.
Oh, right.
It's all
we're still building up his life story.
Yeah, in vaudeville and at the World's Fair and all of this stuff.
Yeah, Coney Island. Wasn't he on Coney Island?
So crazy. So crazy. Yeah, it is not. But I wondered how a Best Picture winner musical, because people continue to love musicals, but how could, because most musicals, right? Most of the great musicals, their reputation has only grown through the years. And here's a musical that won Best Picture, and its reputation has really become more and more tarnished through the years. And absent controversy or racism or things like that, I wondered, how could this happen? Like, you understand why the reputation for Birth of a Nation would take a bit of a blow during the years.
Yes.
But, like, why something like this? And it's because they did not understand at that point in time the show business adage of leave the audience wanting more. This is leaving them wanting nothing more than never to have to see a movie again. But I got my film.
Oh my God.
But so amazing to see some of these performers recreated, to see this double play Will Rogers, who had died that very year. And this guy looks identical to Will Rogers. It is staggering. And but meanwhile, to see Fanny Bryce play herself.
Yeah, she was the original Follies girl, Fanny Bryce.
Pretty terrific. Pretty cool. As a historic text, and with the ability to turn it off and walk away and create intermissions, a fascinating film. But boy, I understand why its reputation has fallen. So we got a little bit of time left. You had 94 hours flying back to Australia.
You know, I did.
I think I speak for everybody when I ask what international comedy selection did we watch on the voyage home?
Well, we can't go any more comedic than the fantastic bank heist thriller from India called Bank Choi, which is, translated is the bank thief. And boy, if you want to learn it's not so much a comedy, but if you want to learn about the slight cultural differences between someone from Mumbai versus someone from Delhi, or hear the accent tonal difference from someone from Zanzibar versus pretending to be from Mumbai, you can't go any further than seeing Bang Choy. This is a bank robbery movie.
I must say that you narrowed that target demographic pretty slim. You sliced that pretty thin, I must say. But if you fall into that description, this is the one. This is one of the movies for you.
This is one of the movies for you. It is, to me, it's fascinating. I thought not only, you know, comedic movements, but it was like, oh, is that the difference between men from Delhi versus the gentleman from Mumbai? Oh, one is more emotional and the other one uses too much water. You know, it's like, what? And
one is too emotional. The other defecates out of doors. That's a callback.
Seems to be the
That's
issue.
A callback to yeah. last week's show. Yeah,
totally. And then for some reason, the lead guy, I don't know what religious end of Hindu or Buddhism he was from, but it was Saturday on the day of this bank heist, so he could not lie. Saturday is the day you cannot lie. Like the rest of the week, you're fine lying, but Saturday you cannot tell a lie. Now, this is I've studied comparative religion, and I am at a loss to figure out which this is attributed to. But apparently somewhere there's, I can't tell a lie because it's Saturday.
Right,
it was a punchline.
It was
used
a punchline.
Over.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's like, I cannot lie, I am a Vulcan. And all the jokes that set up every time he lied. I didn't lie, I exaggerated. Right. I didn't lie. I was in error. It's like it's like Spock became the White House counsel, for God's sakes.
That's right. Absolutely.
It's not a lie.
But,
it's an error.
Yeah, if you want to see a very complex, I mean, story-wise and structurally, really complex twists in there. I think, it might be due for an American redo of this movie just because of how much fun it was and how that thing just kept rolling along. Directed, might I add, by an unknown director of one name only, by the name of Bumpy.
We love Bumpy.
Bumpy.
And would you remake
I'm liking
it,
this guy's work.
Would you remake it here with Indians? I don't want to say American Indians because that people are going to think of casinos at that point. people who derive their heritage from India but live in America now, or would you convert it culturally to other races?
Well, I don't think I'd convert to other races. I think I'd convert it to other cities. You know, sort of like New York. New York's like this, LA's like that. And, you know, you LA bank robbers that have come to New York, blah, blah, blah. But even more subtle than that, like to me, it seemed very, because these Delhiites came to Mumbai to rob this bank. And Mumbai seemed to be very upset that the fellows from Delhi have arrived to tarnish their town with their thieving ways. Yet, and then it goes on from there, the corruption, and it goes all the way to the top. And, you know, the goal is not stealing cash, but in fact, a hard drive that has incriminating evidence against the health minister. You know, it has many layers, which is a fascinating insight into Indian culture.
I want to talk to you real quick with the final moments about two movies, but not necessarily really review them, but two issues that maybe are worthy of future exploration as well. But we talked about Ant-Man and the Wasp last week. And and there's two things about this movie that it's not about whether the movie is good or bad. It's more about, in part, the advertising. But and one of them is, if you have a whole movie that is built around the question of whether it is possible to rescue a character that has been missing for decades, maybe don't have that character on your posters as an old person, right? Because that sends the pretty strong message, they show up as an old person at some point in this movie. And if that point is, I don't know, the climax of the movie?
What?
That's a spoiler. Are you kidding? But I'm dealing with this all the time with distributors, man. You know, you would pull your hair out hearing some of the things that I have to fight tooth and nail against. But it's like, how does this not occur that this is a spoiler? And it's like people, fundamentally, many people, even the people marketing these things, don't care. They don't think about it because they literally don't care if anything's spoiled. And it's so short-sighted, but that's the way that it is. But the other element about this is there is a problem with this technology that Marvel has used very well. Star Wars used it well with Grand Moff Tarkin, with Peter Cushing. Less right. well with Carrie Fisher in Rogue One. But, you know, this CGI right. technique, maybe best of all, it was in Blade Runner 2049. We didn't talk about this. When Sean Young appears?
Yes.
Looking,
I was
Rachel,
yeah, taken aback. I thought, oh
my God,
maybe she's, yeah.
Yeah. That work was terrific. The face morphing onto a younger person, the recreating of it. We've seen this kind of technique, variations on this technique in Terminator Genesis and all these. Never has it been used better than Blade Runner 2049, but also used very well in some of these Marvel movies, especially with Michael Douglas at the beginning of Ant-Man movies, when they've started with prologues that are flashbacks to the 1950s when the Michael Douglas character was Ant-Man. Well, they also use Michelle Pfeiffer, young Michelle Pfeiffer, by using the same technique back in the, you know, whenever it is, 50s, 60s, 70s, I don't know. But, you know, when they were young and they were Ant-Man and the Wasp. This CGI technique is such a danger to the efficacy of plastic surgery. because when Michelle Pfeiffer shows up as the age she currently is, her face looks so much more phony than it did with the phony CGI face of a young person. The CGI is more realistic than plastic surgery. And so that begs an interesting question. Might actors start to think, you know, I don't have to get carved to keep getting roles? If they want to keep using my name and my talent, maybe technology can do it for us in the movie to make me play a variety of ages.
Well, now I've seen this at one of the Cinegraph things. It's a real time Photoshop touch up of a moving image. So even if you're shooting live, you click your DaVinci processor on it and it's totally Photoshops the face of the person walking through in real time in front of the camera, and it removes, you know, kind of puts a soft gel over it, even though the background and everything else stays exactly the same.
How liberating would that potentially be? Like any technology, it can be perverted and probably will be by our Department of Defense. But it's the new Manhattan Project. But it's for really wealthy women who live in Manhattan. They project a CGI field all around them, so they look so much younger. But for an actor, it could be so liberating because you don't alter your all important instrument, right? Which is a face that is elastic, that can move, that can convey, that can express, and that also can wear many different ages. And including the age you really are, and that can grow into other ages. That's one of the worst things about plastic surgery is it prevents you from growing into other ages. And and this makes more possible. Like I said, if you have an actor that you really like their talent, you like their sense of story and what they can bring to all the stories that live within them, what an opportunity this is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, so much back in the day when they said, oh, Botox is great. Well, it deadens your eyebrows, which is a big part of my comedic expressions, right? And so suddenly with deadened eyebrows, regardless of how many wrinkles are on my forehead, I cannot do my hilarious Eugene Levy eyebrow moves.
Exactly. That's your go-to. Yeah. I mean, that is part of the strength and the suppleness that Detroit can look forward to. In fact, you call one eyebrow strength and the other supple.
That's right.
The other thing that I wanted to mention is I saw this sequel to Sicario, Sicario Day of the Soldado. And,
oh, yes. What'd you think?
I think we should use that as Chilpac, Day of the Chilpaco. But so it's not directed by Denis Villeneuve, the great Denis Villeneuve, who did Blade Runner 2049, because he's been so busy with that and with his Dune adaptation. He's replaced in the director's chair by Italian filmmaker Stefano Sollima, best known for directing the rather excellent Gamora television series, though television is a different beast than film.
Yeah.
And in a nutshell, Sicario is interesting once you get to kind of the halfway point, then the movie begins. When things start to go wrong, then the movie begins. Because as we've talked about, story comes out of character. And there was a reason to have a sequel, which was to follow Benicio del Toro's Sicario character. That's why Emily Blunt was not going to be in it. But in a movie that misses Denis Villeneuve, that misses cinematographer Roger Deakins, who was nominated for an Oscar for it, who misses the late composer Johan Johansson, who was nominated for an Oscar for it, and who died suddenly in February, their absences are felt, but it's Emily Blunt who's felt most severely, which is odd because, again, the idea of following this Sicario character made sense as a sequel, but they don't do it. In fact, they don't do it until the halfway point. So there is no character out of which story is flowing. It is just an hour by skilled filmmakers setting up plot and exposition for an hour.
No, you're kidding.
And then story begins. So it's a bit of a disappointment in that regard. But what I wanted to say, and this was something I thought you would find interesting, Denis Villeneuve was asked, and when he took Blade Runner 2049, huge fan of Blade Runner, obviously, his one condition was no interaction with Ridley Scott. He did not want Ridley Scott looking over his shoulder, breathing down his neck.
Good.
And when Sicario 2 was being made, and Denis Villeneuve had to abandon the director's chair because he was busy, he paid it forward. And so he sent an email to Sollima on the first day of shooting and then never had any other interaction. He wanted Stefano Sollima to feel comfortable making his movie. And here's the thing that's the regret is if I were Denis Villeneuve and I ever got the chance to follow up on a Ridley Scott masterpiece that I loved, you know what my one request would be? That Ridley Scott is looking over my shoulder the whole time, because when the hell else am I going to get to interact and collaborate with the master like that?
That's true.
No matter how great I am, and I must be great if I'm considered for the job directing Blade Runner 2049, if I'm that great, I don't have anything to prove anymore. I want the joy of getting to learn from this other man and collaborate with him. And then...
Right.
I might not make the mistake of staying out of a franchise that I started and loved, a franchise that could really have used me looking over the shoulder, because I, Denis Villeneuve, is the director who time and time again has been extolled by screenwriters for understanding structure better than any other director. I would not have been absent when changes could have been made that would have saved that movie.
Shit. So there were change. He needed somebody.
He needed somebody. And it's a collaborative process, right? And you shouldn't be frightened of another director's ego, right? But you're only frightened of that, of their ego, if in some ways you're frightened of your own. And it's a disappointment to me, because at least one of those movies would have been better. I'm not going to say Blade Runner 2049 would have been better. I don't know.
Right.
But certainly Sicario would have been. And I am looking forward to Sicario 3. There is a wonderful setup for it. And I've heard that Villeneuve would return and that Emily Blunt would return. And I would certainly look forward to that. Meanwhile, we will return, Dean Haglund.
We will.
Yeah.
Let us return.
Next week with a brand new installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Can people like us on Facebook, Dean?
Oh, boy, can they. You find us at facebook.com, Chill Pack Hollywood. And there you like us and poke us and whatever the hell
else you do with that. Can they follow us on Twitter and Instagram?
man, with the same handle. We're Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Okay, now important question, and I want you to really think about this. Give an honest answer. Can they write us?
At chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. That's how easy it is. And then we talk about whatever you write, which is what we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Truer words have never been spoken. It must be a Saturday somewhere, because you aren't lying, my friend. Until next week, I'm Phil Bumpy Lairness.
Let it go, Bumpy. I'm Dean Haglund. See you
then. Related spoiler alert.